thought of what I had written about going to bed. I realized I felt guilty, guilty that despite his kindness I had not been able to give myself to my husband. No, I lied. Nothing. I wondered what he might have done differently for me to want to take him in my arms, to let him love me. Flowers. Chocolates. Does he need to make romantic overtures every time he'd like to have sex, as if it were the first time? I realized how closed the avenues of seduction are to him. He can't even play the first song we danced to at our wedding, or recreate the meal we enjoyed the first time we ate out together, because I don't remember what they are. And in any case, I am his wife. He should not have to seduce me as if we had only just met every time he wants us to have sex. But is there ever a time when I let him make love to me, or perhaps even want to make love to him? Do I ever wake and know enough for desire to exist? Unforced? I don't even remember Ben, I said. I had no idea who he was this morning. He nodded. You'd like to? I almost laughed. Of course, I said. I want to remember my past. I want to know who I am, who I married. It's all part of the same thing. Of course, he said. He paused, then leaned his elbows on the desk and clasped his hands in front of his face, as if thinking carefully about what to say or how to say it. What you've told me is encouraging. It suggests that the memories aren't lost completely. The problem is not one of storage, but of access. I thought for a moment, then said, "You mean my memories are there, I just can't get to them?" He smiled. "If you like," he said, "yes." I felt frustrated, eager. So how do I remember more? He leaned back and looked in the file in front of him. "Last week," he said, "on the day I gave you your journal, did you write that I showed you a picture of your childhood home? I gave it to you, I think." "Yes," I said, "I did." "You seemed to remember much more, having seen that photo, than when I asked you about the place where you used to live without showing you a picture of it first." He paused, which again isn't surprising, but I'd like to see what happens if I show you pictures from the period you definitely don't remember. I want to see if anything comes back to you then. I was hesitant, unsure of where this avenue might lead, but certain it was a road I had no choice but to take. "Okay," I said. "Good. We'll look at just one picture today." He took a photograph from the back of the file and then walked round the desk to sit next to me. "Before we look, do you remember anything of your wedding?" I already knew there was nothing there. As far as I was concerned, my marriage to the man I'd woken up with this morning had simply not happened. "No," I said, "nothing."
"You're sure?"
I nodded, "yes." He put the photograph on the desk in front of me. "You got married here," he said, tapping it. "It was of a church, small, with a low roof and a tiny spire. Totally unfamiliar. Anything?" I closed my eyes and tried to empty my mind. A vision of water. My friend. A tiled floor, black and white. Nothing else. "No, I don't remember ever having seen it before." He looked disappointed.
"You're sure?"
I closed my eyes again. Blackness. I tried to think of my wedding day, tried to imagine Ben, me, in a suit and a wedding dress, standing on the grass in front of the church. But nothing came. No memory. Sadness rose in me. Like any bride, I must have spent weeks planning my wedding, choosing my dress and waiting anxiously for the alterations, booking a hairdresser, thinking about my makeup. I imagined myself agonizing over the menu, choosing the hymns, selecting the flowers, all the time hoping that the day would live up to my impossible expectations. And now I have no way of knowing whether it did. It has all been taken from me, every trace erased, everything apart from the man I married. "No," I said. There's nothing. He put the photograph away. According to the notes taken during your initial treatment, you were married in Manchester, he said. The church is called St. Mark's. That was a recent photograph. It's the only one I could get, but I imagine it looks pretty much the same now as it did then. There are no photographs of our wedding, I said. It was both a question and a statement. No, they were lost. In a fire at your home, apparently. I nodded. Hearing him say it cemented it somehow, made it seem more real. It was almost as if the fact he was a doctor gave his words an authority that Ben's didn't have. When did I get married? I said. It would have been in the mid-80s. Before my accident. Dr. Nash looked uncomfortable. I wondered if I had ever spoken to him about the accident that left me with no memory. You know about what caused your amnesia, he said. Yes, I said. I spoke to Ben the other day. He told me everything. I wrote it in my journal. He nodded. How do you feel about it? I'm not sure, I said. The truth was that I had no memory of the accident, and so it didn't seem real. All I had were its effects, the way it had left me. I feel like I ought to hate the person who did this to me, I said, especially as they've never been caught, never been punished for leaving me like this, for ruining my life. But the odd thing is I don't really. I can't. I can't imagine them or picture what they look like. It's like they don't even exist. He looked disappointed. Is that what you think? He said. That your life is ruined? Yes, I said after a few moments. Yes, that's what I think. He was silent. Isn't it? I don't know what I expected him to do or say. I suppose part of me wanted him to tell me how wrong I am, to try and convince me that my life is worth living, but he didn't. He just looked straight at me. I noticed how striking his eyes are. Blue. Flecked with grey. I'm sorry, Christine, he said. I'm sorry, but I'm doing everything I can, and I think I can help you, I really do. You have to believe that. I do, I said. I do. He put his hand on top of mine, where it lay on the desk between us. It felt heavy, warm. He squeezed my fingers, and for a second I felt embarrassed. For him. And also for me. But then I looked into his face, at the expression of sadness I saw there, and realized that his action was that of a young man comforting an older woman. Nothing more. I'm sorry, I said. I need to use the bathroom. When I returned, he had poured coffee and we sat on opposite sides of the desk, sipping at our drinks. He seemed reluctant to make eye contact, instead leafing through the papers on his desk, shuffling awkwardly. At first, I thought he was embarrassed about squeezing my hand, but then he looked up and said, Christine, I want to ask you something. Two things, really. I nodded. First, I've decided to write up your case. It's pretty unusual in the field, and I think it would be really beneficial to get the details out there in the wider scientific community. Do you mind? I looked at the journals, stacked in haphazard piles on the shelves around the office. Is this how he intended to further his career, or make it more secure? Is that why I am here? For a moment I considered telling him I'd rather he didn't use my story, but in the end I simply shook my head and said, No, it's fine. He smiled. Good. Thank you. Now I have a question. More of a sort of idea, really. Something I'd like to try. Would you mind? What were you thinking? I said. I felt nervous, but relieved he was finally about to tell me what was on his mind. Well, he said, according to your files, after you and Ben were married, you continued to live together in the house in East London that you shared. He paused. Out of nowhere came a voice that must have been my mother's, living in sin. A tut, a shake of her head that said everything. And then, after a year or so, you moved to another house. You stayed there pretty much until you were hospitalized.
He paused.
It's quite near where you live now.
I began to understand what he might be suggesting.
I thought we could leave now and visit it on the way home. What do you think?
What did I think? I didn't know. It was an almost unanswerable question.
I knew it was a sensible thing to do, that it might help me in some undefinable way that neither of us could yet understand, but still I was reluctant. It was as if my past suddenly felt dangerous, a place it might be unwise to visit.
I'm not sure, I said.
You lived there for a number of years, he said.
I know, but...
We can just go and look at it. We don't have to go inside.
Go inside? I said.
How... Yes, he said. I've written to the couple who live there now. We've spoken on the phone. They said that if it might help, they'd be more than happy to let you have a look around.
I was surprised by this.
Really? I said.
He looked slightly away, quickly, but enough for it to register his embarrassment. I wondered what he might be hiding.
Yes, he said.
And then...
I don't go to this much trouble for all my patients.
I said nothing.
He smiled. I really think it might help, Christine.
What else could I do?
On the way there, I had intended to write in my journal, but the journey was not long, and I had barely finished reading the last entry when we parked outside a house. I closed the book and looked up. The house was similar to the one we'd left that morning, the one that I had to remind myself I live in now, with its red brick and painted woodwork, and the same bay window and well-tended garden. If anything, this house looked bigger, and a window in the roof suggested a loft conversion that we did not have. I found it hard to understand why we'd left this place to move what must be only a couple of miles away to an almost identical house. After a moment I realized, memories, memories of a better time, before my accident, when we were happy, living a normal life. Ben would have had them, even if I did not. I felt suddenly positive that the house would reveal things to me, reveal my past. I want to go in, I said. I pause, there. I want to write the rest, but it is important, too important to be rushed. And Ben will be home very soon. He is late already. The sky is dark, the street echoing to the sounds of slammed doors as people arrive home from work. Cars slow outside the house. Soon one of them will be Ben's. It is better if I finish now, if I put my book away, hide it safely in the wardrobe. I will continue later. I was replacing the lid of the shoebox when I heard Ben's key in the lock. He called out when he came into the house, and I told him I would be down in a moment. Though I have no reason to pretend I have not been looking in the wardrobe, I closed its door softly, then went to see my husband. The evening was fractured. My journal called to me. As we ate, I wondered if I could write in it before washing up. As I washed up, I wondered if I should feign a headache and write when I finished. But then, after I had tidied the kitchen, Ben said he had a little work to do and went into his office. I sighed, relieved, and told him I would go to bed. That's where I am now. I can hear Ben, the tap, tap, tap of his keyboard, and I admit the sound is comforting. I have read what I wrote before Ben got home, and can now once again picture myself as I was this afternoon, sitting outside a house in which I once lived. I can take up my story. It happened in the kitchen. A woman, Amanda, had answered the doorbell's instant buzz, greeted Dr. Nash with a handshake and me with a look that hovered between pity and fascination.
"You must be Christine," she said, tilting her head to one side and holding out her manicured hand. "Do come in." She closed the door behind us. She was wearing a cream blouse, gold jewellery. She introduced herself and said, "Stay as long as you like, okay? As long as you need."
I nodded and looked around.
We were standing in a bright, carpeted hallway. The sun streamed through the glass panels in the window to pick out a vase of red tulips that sat on a side table. The silence was long and uncomfortable.
"It's a lovely house," Amanda said, eventually. And for a moment I felt as if Dr. Nash and I were prospective purchasers, and she an estate agent keen to negotiate a deal.
"We bought it about 10 years ago. We just adore it. It's so bright. Do you want to go through into the living room?"
We followed her into the lounge. The room was sparse, tasteful. I felt nothing, not even a dull sense of familiarity. It could have been any room in any house in any city.
"Thank you so much for letting us look round," said Dr. Nash.
"Oh, nonsense," she said with a peculiar snort. I imagined her riding horses or arranging flowers.
"Have you done a lot of decorating since you were here?" he said.
"Oh, some," she said. "Bits and pieces."
I looked at the sanded floorboards and white walls, at the cream sofa, the modern art prints that hung on the wall. I thought of the house I'd left this morning. It could not have been more different.
"Do you remember how it looked when you moved in?" said Dr. Nash.
She sighed. "Only vaguely, I'm afraid. It was carpeted. A kind of biscuit colour, I think, and there was wallpaper, sort of striped, if I remember."
I tried to picture the room as she described it. Nothing came.
"There was a fireplace we had removed too. I wish we hadn't now. It was an original feature."
"Christine," said Dr. Nash, "anything?"
When I shook my head, he said, "Do you think we could look round the rest of the house?" We went upstairs. There were two bedrooms. "Giles works from home a good deal," she said as we went into the one at the front of the house. It was dominated by a desk, filing cabinets and books. "I think the previous owners must have used this as their bedroom." She looked at me, but I said nothing. "It's a little bigger than the other room, but Giles can't sleep in here because of the traffic."
There was a pause.
"He's an architect."
Again, I said nothing.
"It's quite a coincidence," she continued, "because the man we bought the house from was also an architect. We met him when we came round to look at the place. They got on quite well. I think we knocked him down by a few thousand just because of the connection."
Another pause. I wondered if she was expecting to be congratulated.
"Giles is setting up his own practice."
An architect, I thought. Not a teacher, like Ben. These can't have been the people that he sold the house to. I tried to imagine the room with a bed instead of the glass-topped desk, carpet and wallpaper replacing the stripped boards and white walls. Dr. Nash turned to face me.
"Anything?"
I shook my head. "No, nothing. I don't remember anything." We looked in the other bedroom, the bathroom. Nothing came to me, and we went downstairs into the kitchen.
"Would you like a cup of tea?" said Amanda. "It's really not a problem. It's made already."
"No, thank you," I said. The room was harsh, hard-edged. The units were chrome and white, and the worktop looked like poured concrete. A bowl of limes provided the only colour.
"I think we ought to leave soon," I said.
"Of course," said Amanda. Her breezy efficiency seemed to have vanished, replaced by a look of disappointment. I felt guilty. She had obviously hoped that a visit to her home would be the miracle that cured me.
"Could I have a glass of water?" I said.
She brightened immediately. "Of course," she said. "Let me get you one." She handed me a glass, and it was then, as I took it from her, that I saw it. Amanda and Dr. Nash had both disappeared. I was alone. On the worktop, I saw an uncooked fish, wet and glistening, lying on an oval plate. I heard a voice, a man's voice. It was Ben's voice, I thought, but younger somehow. "White wine," it said, "or red?" And I turned and saw him coming into a kitchen. It was the same kitchen, the one I was standing in with Dr. Nash and Amanda, but it had different coloured paint on the walls. Ben was holding a bottle of wine in each hand, and it was the same Ben, but slimmer, with less grey in his hair, and he had a moustache. He was naked, and his penis was semi-erect, bobbing comically as he walked. His skin was smooth, taut over the muscles of his arms and chest, and I felt the sharp tug of lust. I saw myself gasp, but I was laughing. "White, I think," he said, and he laughed with me. And then he put both bottles down on the table and came over to where I stood. His arms encircled me, and then I was closing my eyes and my mouth opened as if involuntarily, and I was kissing him and he me, and I could feel his penis pressing into my crotch and my hand moving towards it. And even as I was kissing him, I was thinking, "I must remember this, how this feels. I must put this in my book. This is what I want to write." I fell into him then, pressing my body against his, and his hands began to tear at my dress, groping for the zip. "Stop it," I said, "don't." But even though I was saying no, asking him to stop, I felt as though I wanted him more than I had ever wanted anyone before. "Upstairs," I said, "quick." And then we were leaving the kitchen, tearing at our clothes as we went, and heading up to the bedroom with the grey carpet and blue patterned wallpaper, and all the time I was thinking, yes, this is what I ought to be writing about in my next novel. This is the feeling I want to capture. I stumbled. The sound of breaking glass and the image in front of me vanished. It was as if the spool of film had run through, the images on the screen replaced with a flickering light and the shadows of dust motes. I opened my eyes. I was still there, in that kitchen. But now it was Dr. Nash standing in front of me, and Amanda a little way past him, and they were both looking at me, concerned and anxious. I realized I had dropped the glass. "Christine," said Dr. Nash, "Christine, are you okay?" I didn't answer. I didn't know what to feel. It was the first time, as far as I knew, I had ever remembered my husband. I closed my eyes and tried to will the vision back. I tried to see the fish, the wine, my husband with a moustache, naked, his penis bobbing, but nothing would come. The memory had gone, evaporated as if it had never existed, or had been burned away by the present. "Yes," I said. "I'm fine. What's wrong?" said Amanda. "Are you all right?" "I remembered something," I said. I saw Amanda's hands fly to her mouth. Her expression changed to one of delight. "Really," she said, "that's wonderful. What? What did you remember?" "Please," said Dr. Nash. He stepped forward, taking my arm. Broken glass crunched at his feet. "My husband," I said. "Here, I remembered my husband." Amanda's expression fell. "Is that all?" she seemed to be saying. "Dr. Nash," I said, "I remembered Ben." I began to shake. "Good," said Dr. Nash. "Good, that's excellent." Together, they led me through to the living room. I sat on the sofa. Amanda handed me a mug of hot tea, a biscuit on a plate. "She doesn't understand," I thought. "She can't. I have remembered Ben. Me. When I was young. The two of us together. I know we were in love. I no longer have to take his word for it. It is important. Far more important than she can ever know." I felt excited. All the way home. Lit with nervous energy. I looked at the world outside, the strange, mysterious, unfamiliar world, and in it I did not see threat, but possibility. Dr. Nash told me he thought we were really getting somewhere. He seemed excited. "This is good," he kept saying. "This is good." I wasn't sure whether he meant it was good for me or for him, for his career. He said he'd like to arrange a scan, and almost without thinking, I agreed. He gave me a mobile phone, too, telling me it used to belong to his girlfriend. It looked different from the one Ben had given me. It was smaller, and the casing flipped open to reveal a keypad and screen inside. "A spare," he said. "You can ring me any time. Any time, at the mobile phone, too. Telling me it used to belong to his girlfriend." It looked different from the one Ben had given me. It was smaller, and the casing flipped open to reveal a keypad and screen inside. "A spare," he said. "You can ring me any time. Any time it's important, and keep it with you. I'll call you on it to remind you about your journal." That was hours ago. Now I realize he gave it to me so he could phone me, without Ben knowing. He'd even said as much. I rang the other day, and Ben answered. It might get awkward. This will make things easier. I took it without question. I have remembered Ben. Remembered that I loved him. He will be home soon. Perhaps later, when we go to bed, I will make amends for last night's neglect. I feel alive, buzzing with potential. Tuesday, 13th of November. It is the afternoon. Soon Ben will be home from another day at work. I sit with this journal in front of me. A man, Dr. Nash, called me at lunchtime and told me where to find it. I was sitting in the living room when he rang, and at first did not believe that he knew who I was. "Look in the shoebox in the wardrobe," he'd said eventually. "You'll find a book." I hadn't believed him, but he had stayed on the line while I looked, and he was right. My journal was there, wrapped in tissue. I lifted it out as if it were fragile, and then, once I had said goodbye to Dr. Nash, I knelt by the wardrobe and read it. Every word. I was nervous, though I didn't know why. The journal felt forbidden, dangerous, though this was perhaps only because of the care with which I'd hidden it. I glanced up repeatedly from its pages to check the time, even closed it quickly and put it back in its tissue when there was the sound of a car outside the house. But now I am calm. I am writing this in the window of the bedroom, in the bay. It feels familiar here, somehow, as if this is a place where I sit often. I can see down the street, in one direction to a row of tall trees behind which a park can be glimpsed. In the other to a row of houses, and another busier road. I realize that, though I may choose to keep my journal secret from Ben, nothing terrible would happen if he were to find it. He is my husband. I can trust him. I read again of the excitement I felt on the way home yesterday. It has disappeared. Now I feel content, still. Cars pass. Occasionally someone walks by, a man whistling or a younger mother taking her child to the park and then, later, away from it. In the distance a plane, coming into land, seems almost to be stationary. The houses opposite are empty. The street quiet apart from the whistling man and the bark of an unhappy dog. The commotion of the morning, with its symphony of closing doors and sing-song goodbyes and revved engines, has disappeared. I feel alone in the world. It begins to rain. Large droplets spatter the window in front of my face, hang for a moment, and then, joined by others, begin their slow slide down the pane. I put my hand up to the cold glass. So much separates me from the rest of the world. I read of visiting the home I had shared with my husband. Was it really only yesterday those words were written? They do not feel as if they belong to me. I read of the day I had remembered too, of kissing my husband, in the house we bought together so long ago. And when I close my eyes I can see it again. It is dim at first, unfocused, but then the image shimmers and resolves, snapping to sharpness with an almost overwhelming intensity. My husband, tearing at my clothes, Ben holding me, his kisses becoming more urgent, deeper. I remember we neither ate the fish nor drank the wine. Instead, when we had finished making love, we stayed in bed for as long as we could. Our legs entwined, my head on his chest, his hand stroking my hair, semen drying on my stomach. We were silent. Happiness surrounded us like a cloud. "I love you," he said. He was whispering, as if he had never said those words before, and, though he must have done so many times, they sounded new, forbidden and dangerous. I looked up at him, at the stubble on his chin, the flesh of his lips and the outline of his nose above them. "I love you too," I said, whispering into his chest, as if the words were fragile. He squeezed my body to his then and kissed me softly, the top of my head, my brow. I closed my eyes and he kissed my eyelids, barely brushing them with his lips. I felt safe, at home. I felt as if here, against his body, was the only place in which I belonged, the only place I had ever wanted to be. We lay in silence for a while, holding each other, our skin merging. Our breathing synchronized. I felt as if silence might allow the moment to last forever, which would still not be enough. Ben broke the spell. "I have to leave," he said, and I opened my eyes and took his hand in mine. It felt warm, soft. I brought it to my mouth and kissed it. The taste of glass and earth. "Already," I said. He kissed me again. "Yes, it's later than you think. I'll miss my train." I felt my body plunge. Separation seemed unthinkable, unbearable. "Stay a bit longer," I said. "Get the next one." He laughed. "I can't, Chris," he said. "You know that." I kissed him again. "I know," I said. "I know." I showered after he left. I took my time, soaping myself slowly. Feeling the water on my skin as if it were a new sensation. In the bedroom I sprayed myself with perfume and put on my nightdress and a gown, and then I went downstairs, into the dining room. It was dark. I turned on the light. On the table in front of me was a typewriter, threaded with blank paper, and next to it a shallow stack of pages turned face down. I sat down in front of the machine. I began to type. Chapter 2. I paused then. I could not think what to write next. How to begin. I sighed, resting my fingers on the keyboard. It felt natural beneath me, cool and smooth, contoured to my fingertips. I closed my eyes and typed again. My fingers danced across the keys, automatically, almost without thought. When I opened my eyes, I had typed a single sentence. Lizzie did not know what she had done, or how it could be undone. I looked at the sentence. Solid. Sitting there. On the page. Rubbish, I thought. I felt angry. I knew I could do better. I had done so before, two summers previously when the words had flown out of me, scattering my story onto the page like confetti. But now something was wrong. Language had become solid, stiff, hard. I took a pencil and drew a line through the sentence. I felt a little better with it scored out, but now I had nothing again. Nowhere to start. I stood up and lit a cigarette from the packet that Ben had left on the table. I drew the smoke deep into my lungs, held it, exhaled. For a moment I wished it was weed. Wondered where I could get some from for next time. I poured myself a drink, neat vodka into a whiskey tumbler, and took a mouthful. It would have to do. Writer's block, I thought. How did I become such a fucking cliché? Last time. How did I do it last time? I went over to the bookcases that lined the wall of the dining room and, with a cigarette dangling between my lips, took down a book from the top shelf. There must be clues here, Surely.
I put the vodka down and turned the book over in my hands. I rested my fingertips on the cover, as if the book were delicate, and brushed them gently over the title. "For the Morning Birds," it said. "Christine Lucas." I opened the cover and flicked through the pages. The image vanished. My eyes opened. The room I was in looked drab and grey, but my breathing was ragged. I dimly registered the surprise that I had once smoked, but it was replaced by something else. Was it true? Had I written a novel? Was it published? I stood up. My journal slid from my lap. If so, I had been someone, someone with a life, with goals and ambitions and achievements. I ran down the stairs. Was it true? Ben had said nothing to me this morning, nothing about being a writer. This morning, I had read of our trip to Parliament Hill. There, he had told me I had been working as a secretary when I had my accident. I scanned the bookshelves in the living room, dictionaries, an atlas, a guide to DIY, a few novels, hardback, and, from their condition, I guessed unread. But nothing by me. Nothing to suggest I'd had a novel published. I spun round, half crazy. It must be here, I thought. It must. But then another thought struck me. Perhaps my vision was not memory, but invention. Perhaps, without a true history to hold and ponder, my mind had created one of its own. Perhaps my subconscious decided that I was a writer because that is what I always wanted to be. I ran back upstairs. The shelves in the office were filled with box files and computer manuals, and I had seen no books in either bedroom as I explored the house that morning. I stood for a moment, then saw the computer in front of me silent and dark. I knew what to do, though I didn't know how I knew. I switched it on and it whirred into life beneath the desk, the screen lighting up a moment later. A swell of music from the rattling speaker by the side of the screen, and then an image appeared. A photograph of me and Ben, both smiling. Across the middle of our faces was a box. "Username," it said, and beneath it there was another. "Password." In my vision, I was touch typing, my fingers dancing over the keys as if powered by instinct. I positioned the flashing cursor in the box marked "Username" and held my hands above the keyboard. Was it true? Had I learned to type? I let my fingers rest on the raised letters. They moved effortlessly, my little fingers seeking the keys over which they belonged, the rest falling into place beside them. I closed my eyes, and without thinking began to type, listening only to the sound of my breathing and the plastic clatter of the keys. When I had finished, I looked at what I had done, at what was written in the box. I expected nonsense. But what I saw shocked me. The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. I stared at the screen. It was true. I could touch type. Maybe my vision was not invention but memory. Maybe I had written a novel. I ran into the bedroom. It didn't make sense. For a moment, I had the almost overwhelming feeling that I was going mad. The novel seemed to exist and not exist at the same time, to be real and also totally imaginary. I could remember nothing of it, nothing about its plot or characters, not even the reason I had given it its title, yet still it felt real, as if it beat within me like a heart. And why had Ben not told me, not kept a copy on display? I pictured it, hidden in the house, wrapped in tissue, stored in a box in the loft or the cellar. Why? An explanation came to me. Ben had told me I had been working as a secretary. Perhaps that was why I could type, the only reason. I dug one of the phones out of my bag, not caring which one, hardly even caring who I rang, my husband or my doctor. Both seemed equally alien to me. I flipped it open and scrolled through the menu until I saw a name I recognized, then pressed the call button. "Dr. Nash?" I said when the call was answered. "It's Christine." He began to say something, but I interrupted him. "Listen, did I ever write anything?" "Sorry," he said. He sounded confused.
and for a moment I had the sense I had done something terribly wrong. I wondered whether he even knew who I was, but then he said, "Christine?" I repeated what I had said. I just remembered something, that I was writing something years ago. When I first knew Ben, I think. A novel. Did I ever write a novel? He didn't seem to understand what I meant.
A novel?
Yes, I said. I seem to remember wanting to be a writer when I was little. I just wondered whether I ever wrote anything. Ben told me I worked as a secretary, but I was just thinking...
He hasn't told you? He said.
You were working on your second novel when you lost your memory. Your first was published. It was a success. I wouldn't say it was a bestseller, but it was certainly a success. The words spun in on each other. A novel. A success. Published. It was true. My memory had been real. I didn't know what to say, what to think. I said goodbye, then came upstairs to write this. The bedside clock reads 10:30. I imagine Ben will come to bed soon, but still I sit here on the edge of the bed, writing. I spoke to him after dinner. I had spent the afternoon fretful, pacing from one room to another, looking at everything as if for the first time, wondering why he would so thoroughly remove evidence of even this modest success. It didn't make sense. Was he ashamed? Embarrassed? Had I written about him, our life together? Or was the reason something worse? Something darker I could not yet see. By the time he got home, I had resolved to ask him directly. But now that did not seem possible. It felt like I would be accusing him of lying. I spoke as casually as I could. "Ben," I said, "what did I do for a living?" He looked up from the newspaper. "Did I have a job?"
"Yes," he said. "You worked as a secretary for a while, just after we were married."
I tried to keep my voice even. "Really, I have the feeling I used to want to write."
He folded his pages together, giving me his full attention.
"A feeling?"
"Yes. I definitely remember loving books as a child, and I seem to have a vague memory of wanting to be a writer."
He held out his hand across the dinner table and took mine. His eyes seemed sad, disappointed. "What a shame," they seemed to say. "Bad luck. I don't suppose you ever will now."
"Are you sure?" I began. "I seem to remember..."
He interrupted me. "Christine," he said, "please. You're imagining things." For the rest of the evening I was silent, hearing only the thoughts that echoed in my head. Why would he do that? Why would he pretend I had never written a word? Why? I watched him, asleep on the sofa, snoring softly. Why had I not told him that I knew I had written a novel? Did I really trust him so little? I had remembered us lying in each other's arms, murmuring our love for each other as the sky grew darker. How had we gone from that to this? But then I began to imagine what would happen if I did stumble upon a copy of my novel in a cupboard or at the back of a high shelf. What would it say to me other than, "Look how far you have fallen. Look what you could do. Before a car and an icy road took it all from you, leaving you worse than useless." It would not be a happy moment. I saw myself becoming hysterical, much more so than this afternoon when at least the realization was gradual, triggered by a longed-for memory, screaming, crying. The effect might be devastating. No wonder Ben might want to hide it from me. I picture him now, removing all the copies, burning them in the metal barbecue on the back porch, before deciding what to tell me. How best to reinvent my past to make it tolerable. What I needed to believe for the remainder of my years. But that is over now. I know the truth. My own truth. One I have not been told, but have remembered. And it is written now, etched in this journal rather than my memory. But permanent, nevertheless. I know that the book I am writing, my second, I realize with pride, may be dangerous, as well as necessary. It is not fiction. It may reveal things best left undiscovered, secrets that ought not to see the light of day. But still my pen moves across the page. Wednesday, 14th of November. This morning I asked Ben if he'd ever grown a moustache. I was still feeling confused, unsure of what was true and what not. I had woken early and, unlike previous days, had not thought I was still a child. I had felt adult, sexual. The question in my mind was not, why am I in bed with a man, but instead, who is he? And what did we do? In the bathroom, I looked at my reflection with horror, but the pictures around it seemed to resonate with truth. I saw the man's name, Ben, and it was familiar somehow. My age, my marriage, these facts seemed to be things I was being reminded of, not told about for the first time. Buried, but not deeply. Dr. Nash called me almost as soon as Ben left for work. He reminded me about my journal and then, once he had told me that he would be picking me up later to take me for my scan, I read it. There were a few things in it I could perhaps recall, and maybe whole passages I could remember writing. It was as if some residue of memory had survived the night. Perhaps that was why I had to be sure the things contained within it were true. I called Ben. Ben, I said once he told me he wasn't busy. Did you ever have a moustache? That's an odd question, he said. I heard the clink of a spoon against a cup and pictured him spooning sugar into his coffee. A newspaper spread in front of him. I felt awkward, unsure how much to say. I had a memory, I think. Silence. A memory? Yes, I said, I think so. My mind flashed on the things I had written about the other day. His moustache, his naked body, his erection. And those I had remembered yesterday. The two of us in bed, kissing. Briefly, they were illuminated, before sinking back into the depths. Suddenly, I felt afraid. I just seemed to remember you with a moustache. He laughed, and I heard him put down his drink. I felt solid ground begin to slip away. Maybe everything I had written was a lie. I am a novelist, after all, I thought. Or I used to be. The futility of my logic hit me. I used to write fiction, therefore my assertion that I had been a novelist might be one of those fictions, in which case I had not written fiction. My head spun. It had felt true, though. I told myself that. Plus I could touch type, or I had written that I could. Did you? I asked, desperate. It's just... it's important. Let's think, he said. I imagined him closing his eyes, biting his bottom lip in a parody of concentration. I suppose I might have done, once, he said, very briefly. It was years ago. I forget. A pause, then... yes, actually, yes, I think I probably did. For a week or so. A long time ago. Thank you, I said, relieved. The ground on which I stood felt a little more secure. You okay? He asked. And I said that I was. Dr. Nash picked me up at midday. He told me to have some lunch first, but I wasn't hungry. Nervous, I suppose. We're meeting a colleague of mine, he said in the car. Dr. Paxton. I said nothing. He's an expert in the field of functional imaging of patients with problems like yours. We've been working together. Okay, I said. And now we sat in his car, stationary in stuck traffic. Did I call you yesterday? I asked. He said that I had. You read your journal? Most of it. I skipped bits. It's already quite long. He seemed interested. What sections did you skip? I thought for a moment. There are parts that seem familiar to me. I suppose they feel as if they're just reminding me of things I already know, already remember. That's good. He glanced at me. Very good. I felt a glow of pleasure. So what did I call about? Yesterday. You wanted to know if you'd really written a novel, he said. And had I? Have I? He turned back to me. He was smiling. Yes, he said. Yes, you have. The traffic moved again and we pulled away. I felt relief. I knew what I had written was true. I relaxed into the journey. Dr. Paxton was older than I expected. He was wearing a tweed jacket, and white hair sprouted unchecked from his ears and nose. He looked as though he ought to have retired. Welcome to the Vincent Hall Imaging Center, he said, once Dr. Nash had introduced us, and then, without taking his eyes off mine, he winked and shook my hand. Don't worry, he added. It's not as grand as it sounds. Here, come in. Let me show you round. We made our way into the building. We're attached to the hospital and the university here, he said as we went through the main entrance, which can be both a blessing and a curse. I didn't know what he meant and waited for him to elaborate. But he said nothing. I smiled. Really? I said. He was trying to help me. I wanted to be polite. Everyone wants us to do everything, he laughed. No one wants us to pay for any of it. He walked through into a waiting room. It was dotted with empty chairs, copies of the same magazines Ben has left for me at home, Radio Times, Hello, now joined by Country Life and Marie Claire, and discarded plastic cups. It looked like there had recently been a party that everyone had left in a hurry. Dr. Paxton paused at another door. Would you like to see the control room? Yes, I said. Please. Functional MRI is a fairly new technique, he said, once we'd gone through. Have you heard of MRI? Magnetic resonance imaging? We were standing in a small room, lit only by the ghostly glow from a bank of computer monitors. One wall was taken up by a window, beyond which was another room, dominated by a large cylindrical machine, a bed protruding from it like a tongue. I began to feel afraid. I knew nothing of this machine. Without memory, how could I? No, I said. He smiled. I'm sorry. MRI is a fairly standard procedure. It's a little like taking an X-ray through the body. Here we're using some of the same techniques, but actually looking at how the brain works, at function. Dr. Nash spoke then, the first time in a while he had done so, and his voice sounded small, almost timid. I wondered whether he was in awe of Dr. Paxton, or was desperate to impress him. If someone has a brain tumor, then we need to scan their head to find out where the tumor is, what part of the brain is affected. That's looking at structure. What functional MRI allows us to see is which part of the brain you use when you do certain tasks. We want to see how your brain processes memory. Which parts light up, as it were, said Paxton, where the juices are flowing. That will help, I asked. We hope it will help us to identify where the damage is, said Dr. Nash, what's gone wrong, what's not working properly. And that will help me to get my memory back. He paused and then said, We hope so. I took off my wedding ring and my earrings and put them in a plastic tray. You'll need to leave your bag in here too, said Dr. Paxton. And then he asked me if I had anything else pierced. You'd be surprised, my dear, he said when I shook my head. Now she's a bit of a noisy old beast. You'll need these. He handed me some yellow earplugs. Ready? I hesitated. I don't know. Fear was beginning to creep over me. The room seemed to shrink and darken, and through the glass the scanner itself loomed.
I had the sense I had seen it before, or one just like it.
I'm not sure about this, I said.
Dr. Nash came over to me then. He placed his hand on my arm.
It's completely painless, he said. Just a little noisy.
It's safe.
Perfectly. I'll be here, just on this side of the glass. We'll be able to see you all the way through.
I must have still looked unsure because then Dr. Paxton added,
Don't worry. You're in safe hands, my dear. Nothing will go wrong.
I looked at him and he smiled and said, You might want to think of your memories as being lost. Somewhere in your mind. All we're doing with this machine is trying to find out where they are.
It was cold, despite the blanket they had wrapped around me, and dark, except for a red light blinking in the room, and a mirror, hung from a frame a couple of inches above my head, angled to reflect the image of a computer screen that sat somewhere else. As well as the earplugs, I was wearing a set of headphones through which they said they would talk to me, but for now they were silent. I could hear nothing but a distant hum, the sound of my breathing, hard and heavy, the dull thud of my heartbeat. In my right hand I clutched a plastic bulb filled with air.
Squeeze it if you need to tell us anything, Dr. Paxton had said. We won't be able to hear you if you speak.
I caressed its rubbery surface and waited. I wanted to close my eyes, but they had told me to keep them open, to look at the screen. Foam wedges kept my head perfectly still. I could not have moved, even if I'd wanted to. The blanket over me, like a shroud. A moment of stillness, and then a click. So loud that I started, despite the earplugs, and it was followed by another, and a third. A deep noise, from within the machine or my head, I couldn't tell, a lumbering beast, waking, the moment of silence before the attack. I clutched the rubber bulb, determined that I would not squeeze it, and then a noise, like an alarm or a drill, over and over again, impossibly loud, so loud that the whole of my body shook with each new shock. I closed my eyes. A voice in my ear.
Christine, it said.
Can you open your eyes, please?
They could see me then, somehow.
Don't worry. It's all fine.
Fine, I thought. What do they know about fine? What do they know about what it's like to be me, lying here, in a city I don't remember, with people I've never met? I am floating, I thought, completely without anchor, at the mercy of the wind.
A different voice, Dr. Nash's. Can you look at the pictures? Think what they are. Say it. But only to yourself. Don't say anything out loud.
I opened my eyes. Above me, in the little mirror, were drawings, one after the other, white on black. A man, a ladder, a chair, a hammer. I named each one as it came, and then the screen flashed the words, Thank you, now relax. And I said that to myself, too, to keep myself busy, wondering at the same time how anyone could relax in the belly of a machine like this. More instructions flashed on the screen. Recall a past event, it said, and then beneath it flashed the words, A party.
I closed my eyes.
I tried to think of the party I had remembered as Ben and I watched the fireworks. I tried to picture myself on the roof next to my friend, to hear the noise of the party beneath us, to taste the fireworks on the air. Images came, but they did not seem real. I could tell I was not remembering, but inventing them. I tried to see Keith, to remember him ignoring me, but nothing would come. Those memories were lost again to me, buried, as if forever, though now at least I know that they exist, that they are in there somewhere, locked away. My mind turned to childhood parties, birthdays with my mother and aunt and my cousin Lucy.
Twister. Pass the parcel. Musical chairs, musical statues. My mother with bags of sweets to wrap up as prizes. Sandwiches of potted meat and fish paste with the crust removed. Trifle and jelly. I remembered a white dress with frills at the sleeves. Frilled socks. Black shoes. My hair is still blonde, and I'm sitting at a table in front of a cake with candles. I take a deep breath, lean forward, blow. Smoke rises in the air. Memories of another party crowded in then. I saw myself at home, looking out of my bedroom window. I am naked, about 17. There are trestle tables out in the street, arranged in long rows, loaded with trays of sausage rolls and sandwiches, jugs of orange squash. Union jacks are everywhere. Bunting hangs from every window, blue, red, white. There are children in fancy dress. Pirates, wizards, Vikings. And the adults are trying to organize them into teams for an egg and spoon race. I can see my mother on the other side of the street fastening a cape around Matthew Soper's neck. And, just below my window, my father sits in a deck chair with a glass of juice. "Come back to bed," says a voice. I turn round. Dave Soper sits in my single bed underneath my poster of the slits. The white sheet is twisted around him, spattered with blood. I had not told him it was my first time. "No," I say, "get up. You have to get dressed before my parents come back." He laughs, though not unkindly. "Come on." I pull on my jeans. "No," I say, reaching for a t-shirt. "Get up, please." He looks disappointed. I didn't think this would happen, which doesn't mean I didn't want it to. And now I would like to be alone. It is not about him at all. "Okay," he says, standing up. His body looks pale and skinny, his penis almost absurd. I look away as he dresses, out of the window. My world has changed, I think. I have crossed a line, and I cannot go back. "Bye then," he says. But I don't speak. I don't look back until he has left. A voice in my ear brought me back to the present. "Good. More pictures now, Christine," said Dr. Paxton. "Just look at each one and tell yourself what or who it is, okay? Ready?" I swallowed hard. What would they show me? Who? How bad could it be? Yes, I thought to myself. And we began. The first photograph was black and white. A child. A girl, 4 or 5 years old, in the arms of a woman. The girl was pointing to something, and they were both laughing, and in the background, slightly out of focus, was a fence with a tiger resting on the other side of it. A mother, I thought to myself, a daughter, at a zoo. And then, with a shock of recognition, I looked at the child's face and realized that the little girl was me. The mother my own. Breath caught in my throat. I couldn't remember ever going to a zoo, yet here we were. Here was the evidence that we had. "Me," I said silently, remembering what I had been told. "Mother." I stared at the screen, trying to burn her image into my memory, but the picture faded and was replaced by another. Also of my mother, now older, yet not seeming old enough to need the walking stick on which she is leaning. She was smiling but looked exhausted. Her eyes sunk deep in her thin face. "My mother," I thought again. And other words came, unbidden, in pain. I closed my eyes involuntarily. Had to force them open again. I began to grip the bulb in my hand. The images came quickly then, and I recognized only a few. One was of the friend I had seen in my memory, and with a thrill I recognized her almost straight away. She looked as I had imagined her, dressed in old blue jeans and a t-shirt, smoking, her red hair loose and untidy. Another picture showed her with her hair cut short and dyed black, and a pair of sunglasses pushed high on her head.
It was followed by a photograph of my father. The way he looked when I was a little girl, smiling, happy, reading a newspaper in our front room. And then one of me and Ben, standing with another couple I didn't recognize. Other photos were of strangers. A black woman in a nurse's uniform. Another woman dressed in a suit, sitting in front of a bookcase, peering over the top of her half-moon glasses with a grave expression. A man with ginger hair and a round face. Another with a beard. A child, 6 or 7. A boy eating an ice cream and then, later, the same boy, sitting at a desk, drawing. A group of people arranged loosely, looking at the camera. A man, attractive, his hair black and slightly longish, with a pair of dark-rimmed glasses framing narrowed eyes and a scar running down the side of his face. They went on and on, these photographs. And as they did so, I looked at them all and tried to place them to remember how, or even whether, they were woven into the tapestry of my life. I did as I'd been asked. I was good. And yet I felt myself begin to panic. The whir of the machine seemed to rise in pitch and volume until it became an alarm, a warning, and my stomach clenched. I could not breathe, and I closed my eyes, and the weight of the blanket began to press down on me, heavy as a marble slab, so that it felt like I was drowning. I squeezed my right hand, but it balled itself into a fist, closing on nothing. Nails bit into flesh. I had dropped the bulb. I called out a wordless cry. "Christine," came a voice in my ear. "Christine." I couldn't tell who it was or what they wanted me to do, and I cried out again and began kicking the blanket off my body. "Christine!" Louder now, and then the siren noise whirred to a halt. A door crashed open, and there were voices in the room, and hands on me, on my arms and legs, and across my chest, and I opened my eyes.